5:02 p.m., I'm going to call the meeting to order. Any changes to the agenda, additions or deletions from either of you?
None from me.
I don't have any.
Okay, I do have to add two things under action. KBS agreement, and then Orleans...
The auditors.
Yep, the auditors. And then Orleans County Fair Association payment agreement request. Okay. Other than that, I don't have anything else. Privilege of the floor, I'm going to wait until after. I'm going to kind of redo this. So this privilege of the floor will hold after our other item, which is going to be the meeting discussion with Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, Drinking Water and Groundwater Protection Division and Tailwater Engineering regarding our increased levels of TTHMs, which is a group of disinfection byproducts. So welcome. I think we've already introduced, so Josh and Matt are here with the state, and then Stan and Brad from Tailwater Engineering. We're here because of the notice of violation for our increase in the TTHMs. Josh, you handed out this graphic.
Sure. Yeah, there's a couple of different sheets on it.
Okay.
Just kind of tracking TTHM levels.
Okay.
By quarter.
And this is, all right, this is obviously our data, so
yes.
Perfect. And so we have to come up with a plan as to how we're going to fix this because it has gone on far too long. And so these gentlemen I've had lots of conversations with over the last 3 months. I appreciate all the guidance and support and assistance that you've provided to me. It's greatly appreciated. I'm new to this process and notice of violations and how to respond to them and so forth. So thank you. You both had offered to come to meet with us as a board to discuss our issue and help us, you know, determine possibly what next steps are. Tailwater Engineering is here because they've been involved with us since the fall, September, where we were potentially talking about possibly blending our well water, our groundwater, with our source water from May Pond. Whether that is going to resolve the issue or not, I just felt it would be a great opportunity to have all parties here sitting in the same room to start the conversation as far as next steps, recommendations, and so forth. One thing that I had asked, I believe, when Matt and Joshua and I were talking last week, were, you know, they wanted to know what we were looking for. And I think I had just basically wanted you to explain the disinfection byproducts, the high levels of TTHMs, what causes them, you know, what next steps for us are going to be to resolve this issue. And then we've had multiple conversations where it has been expressed that we are not the only municipality that is suffering this issue. And so if everybody could hear that from you, the experts, I think that would be extremely helpful for us because it's by no means Barton Village not doing what needs to be done. So we want to do what's right and get it fixed and corrected and stop answering these notice of alleged violations.
So
now what we did last year was dredging something
so
that
we
didn't do a whole lot, and it would have by now if
well,
it was going to.
So we dredged the pond before the reservoir on Doyle Lane. I want to say it was like middle to end of May. And the previous water operator had explained to me that it might take up to a year for that to clear. I don't know if, I mean, so we're not quite at a year.
No, it was something that he and I had discussed.
Okay.
And just sort of in anticipation of kicking up sediment via dredging and not understanding the hydraulics of the system, just estimating that it could take, you know, a significant amount of time, maybe even a year to kind of understand what your DBPs are going to look like following doing that.
Right. Of course, this time of year, although you wouldn't know, it is spring. We just had winter again, but we have lots of melt. I'm assuming May Pond is moving because of the melt and the ice and everything's shifting, correct? I'm looking to see what you think.
I mean, at this point, with TTHM levels just kind of steadily increasing, even post-dredging, we're really not seeing any sort of decline like we would want to. And as I had expressed to the previous operator when he submitted the dredging plan, that, you know, were this not to work, we would pursue some other alternate treatment or change of treatment to try to wrangle the DBPs.
Okay. What would that possibly be? So the next steps would be having an engineer involved?
Yeah. So the next steps are going to look like the engineers being involved, developing selecting a treatment option for doing that. I know that I think Matt had recently expressed that aeration within the storage tank had been discussed. And
yeah, I just want to clarify, sure. Not necessarily a treatment, a chosen alternative. Treatment is one of those alternatives.
Sorry.
There are other, you know, treatment is a term we use in a pretty specific technical way to, you know, you're applying a chemical or similar to the water. In this instance, with treating the total trihalomethanes, there are non-treatment options available. There's still modifications or improvements to the system, but they're not specifically a treatment. So, sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's a good clarification, Matt. Thank you. So, in this case, aeration is a pretty easy technology to kind of install, and it handles TTHMs pretty well. I know it had been brought up when we came back up when we were.
This
out
is
here.
The water that's sitting in
the storage tank.
Yeah.
Oh, the storage tank.
As
tanks.
Far as
okay, yes.
aeration
storage
goes,
tank.
What you would do is you'd put a sprayer in the tank, maybe multiple sprayers in the tank that would aerosolize your water up into the air gap above the water level in the tank. There would have to be holes drilled in either side of the tank to move, and air would have to be moved out, because the idea is you're going to. The greatest constituent of your DBPs is chloroform, and if you aerosolize chloroform, you need to move it out of the air, otherwise it'll just move back into the water. But it readily aerosolizes, and it's easily evacuated from storage tanks, and it is an alternative to treatment that I think you've already discussed it with Ray.
Yeah, Gina and I discussed a little bit as well when I was up here last week.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, a week ago today, so Jeremiah, who's been doing our daily testing, you know, our turbidity levels were high, which, you know, time of year. So he had reached out to Matt, and Matt said, you know what, with everything that's going on, let's do a site visit. So it was actually great. So Jeremiah was there, myself, Matt, who was there from Vermont Rural Water?
Brad and Aaron, I think.
Yes. And then David Duquette, our operator, licensed operator, was also there. And so it was, and Ray Solomon, who was the chemist, correct? But they went through the plant, and they, you know, Ray gave some recommendations. We had conversations about how, you know, we have quite large volumes of storage, and if it just sits there,
haven't
that might
be.
Haven't
we talked about,
we
like,
have.
Do we, I think it was for fire protection or something.
Yep. So the previous operator's concerns, because I guess in the past I've been told that they did close down one because they obviously cleaned it and whatnot, and then they kept it down to see if that did decrease things, and it did. But the previous operator's concern was, what if there were a fire? And so he was really hesitant about that, and he was very hesitant about that when we had the conversation, I believe, in September, when we had representatives from the state and the engineers there to discuss the feasibility of blending the well water with the surface water. But it's definitely, I think, something that really needs to be considered here, given that we have to fix this situation.
Right.
And I think it was determined that if we did reduce it, we were still in code.
Well
in code, right?
You were like, that's a huge tank compared to your usage. So your average daily usage is somewhere around 40,000-ish gallons a day, just kind of shoot from the hip looking at your operating reports. The tank is 650,000 gallons with both cells online. So even if you took one cell off and then said our float is our daily usage, 40,000-ish gallons on there, you would still have 190,000 gallons. What was that, 325 minus 40,000, 285. So even at 1,500 gallons a minute for fire flow, you still probably, for 2 hours, 1,500 gallons a minute, you still have over 3 days of storage, average day storage, one cell. So if you're not talking about fire flow and you're just talking about shutting down, that tank's like 16 days worth of water in that tank at your average
in
day.
One tank.
In both cells.
In both cells.
So if you did half of that, I mean, you're 8 days
yep.
with one cell if you didn't have a fire. Yep. So the code, the rule is 60,000 gallons for fire flow. That's 2 hours, 500 gallons a minute. Your permit to operate, I don't really know what your fire flows are within town, your needed fire flows, or what your fire department looks for. But 1,000, 1,500 gallons a minute is usually pretty good, and that's usually kind of pushing the limits of where you should be with your distribution system anyway. So at that, even at 1,500 gallons, you have quite a lot of water.
Would we have to have some concern, like during the drought season or summer?
One of the things Gina and I discussed when I was up here last week was the ability to operationally adjust the system and this exact configuration dependent on the system's needs. So one of those important needs obviously would be planning for drought conditions. Right. So when you start to come into an issue, where things are drying out, the area is entering a drought, you could choose to, run the plant more frequently, fill that tank up and have a bit more of a buffer. Additionally, if you're dealing with, a leak in the distribution system that you're chasing around for a week, you could, try to bump that storage tank level up such that if it gets worse, you've, again, got a bit of a buffer there. And conversely, during times where you're not dealing with those kind of challenges, you're still leaving yourself, a pretty good surplus, as was just described, between the requisite 60,000 gallons for fire flow plus your average day demand. And, when we were talking, I was shooting on kind of the high end and saying about 60,000 for that as well. But if you were to take, for example, your fire flow and say, let's triple it, let's do, 2 hours at 1,500 gallons a minute to, give ourselves, some wiggle room there, you still, when you put those numbers together, have plenty of room to adjust.
Now, if, say, we did do something of that nature, now, can we run half in one tank, half in the other tank, and make it easier to aerate? And then, we could always run a hair more than just if it was one tank.
I think the specifics of such a configuration would get into like when it's engineered and designed, because I think that, and you guys of course can correct me if I'm misspeaking, I'm not an engineer, it's going to depend how the tank is specifically configured and what the aeration setup looks like. I'm speculating if it's a standard concrete tank, I have not opened the hatch and looked inside of it, you would have an aeration setup of whatever specific configuration, one in each cell. You could choose to operate it either way. You could take one cell offline and run one cell pretty much full. You could, they're manifolded together, of course, so you could just run the level lower and utilize both cells. There's some operational flexibility there.
Now, would it be, I guess not being an engineer, neither am I, but so having it broken in half wouldn't make it easier to aerate, or would it aerate faster, quicker?
I haven't specifically looked at the plans, but these tanks typically are physically divided by a wall. Mm-hmm. So whatever you're going to do for your, if you want to do the air stripping method, you're going to have to do it in either cell if you want to be able to use both cells. You're pretty much kind of two, it might be similar manifolded systems for your aeration above, but your two dispersal systems inside the each cell. Just because of the geometry, the way these tanks are built, they're actually physically divided. So even if you're running them at the same level, you would still need
one in both.
On each side. Yep.
But I would think it would be quicker for that water to be aerated if it was split into two tanks and running an aerator in each tank, of course. But
yeah, I don't think once it's established and the system's in place, it's not really the rate at which it would uptake.
Oh,
okay. Doesn't necessarily matter. It's more maintaining that equilibrium, because your usage, your flexibility once your system online is really your average day usage. It's really your what's your float in the tank. And once you've established that environment and you've got the water age, you have to maintain your chlorine contact time too, which is another thing that we would have to double check the geometry of the tank and make sure that you're getting your disinfection that you need to get. But what I saw when I went up and visited the plant as well is that that's a pretty easy solution to make if you guys are comfortable as a community cutting your water age in half, which is one of the biggest variables to development of these constituents. if you make that change, that you may see a significant reduction that you might not then need to do the airstripping. So you, that's a pretty easy operational change to make. That's no cost, no investment. It buys you some time. If you see a benefit, buys you time to look at these other alternatives, like the aeration in the tank or reinvesting in the well that's already drilled and seeing what we can do with that. Because if you're talking about drought conditions and everything as well, that's another avenue to explore, is that if we can get 30 gallons a minute, 50% of your normal demand out of that well, that significantly reduces the burden on your surface water source.
David might have said that I was, there was a lot said last Tuesday, I'm not going to lie, something about maybe a chemical change, changing the hypo.
That's an option. That is not the first option I would recommend you look at.
Okay.
I believe what he would have been talking about is the option to monochloraminate the water. So it's essentially an additional treatment process by which you convert the free chlorine to a different, more stable residual, a different chemical compound in the water. That's what some very large systems do. There's one in the state of Vermont right now, and I mean like physically large distribution systems, where you're just not able to reduce your DBPs through any of these means that we've been talking about already, so you convert it and you chloraminate the water. That is a significantly more involved option and more expensive option than what we're talking about now.
Yeah, operationally, you would see some real significant changes, and I'm not sure how it would impact your operator contract, because it's so much more complex to run the system.
Okay.
It's an option on the table. I think we explore
but
the
that would be like
first.
Way last.
Yeah, in my opinion. It's not my water system, but in my opinion, yes.
I would agree with that opinion. I'm not a fan.
Well, I was going to say, what's your opinion? Because you're like...
I've worked on some projects where we reviewed chloramines, and it is extremely, I know Burlington runs it, that's how they do it. We looked at it up at a surface water plant using Grand Isle Consolidated Water District. We did a whole study on it. And it's just one of those things where you have to add ammonia to the water and you lock it in and it binds with the chlorine. So you have this new thing, new chemistry out there that you're trying to maintain. It's more resilient, but there's other issues. A lot of people showed up to the meeting saying that they were having all sorts of skin issues.
Oh.
And oh yeah, that is the last resort, in my opinion, you want to go down.
There's a reason nobody does it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just operationally, I think it's one of those things where you don't want to deal with the headache that will cause.
Okay.
I think you have way better solutions to fix this problem than that.
So would you concur with aeration first, or reducing the storage tanks, the volume?
I think the reduction of the storage tanks is the low-hanging fruit when I look at this. Just get, if the fire department, I think this is a community decision, right? But it appears to me, like, if this is made for fire storage, you have a lot of water in way more water than most towns have on hand, like for something like this. So like 1,500 gallons per minute for 2 hours is generally plenty of water for fire demands for your village, for this town. So if you just use that number and then your average day demand, I think you could cut your storage in half. And then I would retest and just monitor it. And I think that's your easiest way out, in my opinion.
Where that hasn't been tried yet here, my gut feeling is that that should be tried.
Mm.
And from what I will do following this is I can reach out to both yourself, Gina, and David Duquette, and just request a DBP reduction plan from you, which would identify, yes, we want to try this. We want to do this. If this doesn't work, this is our next step, which, you know, in this case might be aeration.
Yeah.
From the sounds of it, or you know, whatever you want to choose, chloramination, you can go that route as well. But it would identify the next steps. But operation, like where this has not been attempted, and the previous operator was resistant to doing this, I would strongly recommend
trying it
from here.
It really does.
I think that it would, you know, yield significant results.
From our state perspective, in the DBP reduction plan that Josh is describing, as well as, you know, a significant operational shift like this, we would be looking for something pretty concrete from you. So just to be clear, it's not necessarily a one paragraph, we're going to use less water and you'll lower our storage tanks. It's going to be like during the summer months when DBP formation is higher, we're going to limit ourselves to a tank level of this. In the wintertime when DBP reduction is reduced, we have, you know, flexibility to go up to this level. Like, it would be fairly prescribed, and you can still bake in a lot of that flexibility that we discussed, given the enormous volume of water that you have in your storage tank relative to the fire and system demands. But it would need to be pretty clearly spelled out, like, this is the level that we are reducing to, and, you know, under these conditions, we could go up to.
And that would be something you guys, as engineers, would do, correct?
That yeah, we can definitely help with that to help develop that plan. It's hard to know exactly what that's going to do to your DBP development and specify specific levels and say this is going to work in the winter, this is going to work in the summer, without at least trying to correlate some data by trying some sort of reduction and seeing how it correlates to the reduction in DBP. So I'm in agreement with, I think, everybody here that trying half the tank, reducing the volume, if every as a community you're okay. Going down, knowing that you still have significant fire flow capacity and average day storage, and seeing what that does to your DBP levels and what kind of reductions we see. If it's down, we continue to track it, monitor it, and then I would say buying time to pursue an alternative plan with the two that I see are really the aeration in the tank or development of that well and starting to blend your source with a source that doesn't have any organic or very minimal organic carbon in it. So you're not seeing the precursors, so you're getting at the other end. You've already invested in that well, and it's up there. It's
right.
You're trying to at least do the pump test and the compliance sampling to see what you would be up against and what kind of capacity you could get. And then that also your resiliency for your source. You can see somewhere else you can produce water that's not tied to Maybaugh.
Right. And by moving forward with that, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to go back to our previous meetings and conversations. We would be able, by signing the agreement with you to do that, we would be able to apply for state revolving
water loans. Yeah, so we would try to do this all under step one, which right now I think is 25% subsidy, 75% loan. So our original agreement did include a lot of this stuff. We would obviously want to sharpen our pencil and revisit it, because that was a while ago. But that included the cost for the well driller, the hydro geo, I think it was 130, somewhere in there was the total cost of what we came up with. So that would be 25% subsidized and 75% 0% loan.
Yep.
Yeah, 130.
Is there any way, like for fire protection, that the well could be set up to draw off from that if there is a fire?
Not tied to your system without it being an approved source. And the capacity that you're going to get out of the well is it's a drop in the bucket compared to what you'd be looking for firefighting capability.
I didn't want to have a conversation with Chief Rowell because I instantly am thinking we have the river.
We have Crystal Lake.
We, you know, there's May Pond. There are sources here, so, you know, if we did have a catastrophe, a large fire, you know, there's other resources, but.
One thought I just had, too, is we could almost mimic and estimate the DBP formation. We could go out and take a sample, spike it, estimate the current water age, and measure your DBPs now and see if we play around with a couple different days. If you guys want to try, if you're going to get pushback on this, I think there's a way we could almost mimic this just doing some testing. Like if we estimated 16 days of storage right now, and that's what the formation is, and we're getting these high DBPs, we could actually take a sample, spike it with chlorine, and measure it after 3 days. 4 days, what is actually going to be in the tank and see if we actually see a reduction. If you wanted to invest a little bit of time and or money into just trying to get some baseline data for maybe what would happen out in distribution. It's always different, but at least it's something to start with.
And I will say that you know, if you do pursue a reduction in tank level first, you're coming up on the summer months here, which are going to be your, those are going to be your highest producing DBP months anyways. So if you do attempt that and you run it over the summer months, you would get some pretty useful data right off the bat and be able to say, okay, during time of year when we produce the most, this is what we're now producing. You know, that obviously doesn't cover weird examples of just, you know, heat waves and flood, but it would give you a pretty good look at what you're normal.
But I'm, like, I mean, we have to do something at this point.
Yeah.
And my feeling is if the engineers have put it together and this, we have enough water to do fires and that type of thing, and it's going to, everything's going to kind of work together, then I think we have to do something.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I think I'll have a conversation with Chief Rowell.
Would he know the fire flow that we would need?
He should. I would hope so. I would think so. Yep. Yeah.
And maybe we're just so far over what we would really need that.
The other,
you know,
storage is only one. I try to make this point to communities because everybody's old systems see water breaks, Montpelier, Barry, you know, some of these higher pressure systems. I try to make the point that just because you have a number in your system that's 3,500 or 4,000, 5,000, 500, whatever it is, just because you may have that volume in the tank doesn't mean that you can safely get it to the point of the fire through a hydrant without impacting your distribution system,
right,
causing a break or anything like that. So if your system is only 8-inch, you really can't do much more than 1,500 gallons a minute and keep your velocities under control where you're not worried about damaging your system. So, now, that is one thing to think about, is just because you have a ton of water up on the hill, if you've only got 2-inch mains or 4-inch mains, or, you know, you can only get that water so far before you're doing damage to your other assets.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
They'd be able to consider the fire at Bernie's, too.
Yeah, because they... Because
there was a lot of water used there.
Also, with the valve...
And it was through our hydrant.
Right.
There may be an opportunity to keep some water up there and just not have it connected to distribution, and then you'd have to, I would assume, maintain some sort of residual in there, but keep it more as dry storage for a truck to go up and access. It doesn't sound like you would need that because you have other sources.
Yeah, I don't think we would.
Right.
No. Okay.
Yeah.
No, I think. It does sound to me like the next step is to have sort of this community level discussion, certainly looping in the fire department and the fire chief, and figuring out what you see your actual needs are. This is where it gets really, the ball is in your court with this. From a regulatory perspective, we don't require you to have fire flow. You could, I'm not suggesting you do this, but you could say, we don't even want to have fire flow anymore and walk away from it. You could say, if we're going to have it, 60,000, we're going to go with the bare minimum. Or you could say, we feel based on, you know, our needs and our historical experience that we are more comfortable having this level. So that's a discussion you all need to have and figure out, and then incorporate that into whatever the DBP reduction plan is, what you're looking at, how much are we going to lower the tank levels, potentially working with these guys to see, you know, what that formation might look like, and kind of put those pieces of the puzzle together, and that's where you provide us something more specific.
Okay.
To be clear, it's also, you know, we go into, even if you had said, you know, we're going to go straight to aeration, or we're going to go straight to, and you know, any of the other options, you don't know what the outcome is going to be for sure until you do it. So we understand that you may say, we're going to come in and we're proposing a 50% reduction. We may review that and say, that looks good to us. And 6 months from now, we might all be sitting here again going, well, we gave it a shot, and it didn't work out. We reduced them and didn't reduce them enough, or, you know, maybe it works great. So we know there's a degree of...
But as long as we're working on something and we're trying something...
Yeah, and there's an approval associated with that DBP reduction plan. If you were to come back and say, we're going to reduce it by 10,000 gallons, we would say, not good enough. So, you know, well, it's would be something that you know, in good faith believe is going to work. I think there's merit to the idea. You know, propose it once you've had a chance to work with your engineers, work with your fire department, engage your community in whatever way you need to, and then propose something to us. We'll, you know, sign off on it, provided that it works, and then we'll try that.
Okay. Without other municipalities' names that are experiencing the same issue, what have you seen for their resolution? Anything similar to our case? Like, I know...
The closest analog that I can think of to your case is a water system that also has a well that
They have typically done a very low percentage well blend. Their DBP reduction plan and the way that they've kind of tackled this is they have a temperature now within their O&M. They have a procedure. When the temperature exceeds X amount, they will switch on to an 80% well blend. And then once the temperature decreases past that same gate, they will switch back on their surface water system. And that accommodates their usage needs in the winter and the summer, while also tackling the TTHM issue that they have. We have several systems with HA5 issues, which is a more difficult nut to crack. There's no real easy solution to aeration that can get rid of it. It's a more of a treatment change or a precursor removal. We met with a system 5 hours ago that's much, much larger and is, you know, undergoing a major treatment change as a result. So.
And how big is their tanks?
Millions of gallons.
Wow. Significantly larger system in all
ways. Yeah, in all regards. So the problem is both with smaller surface water systems and with some of the largest systems in the state that are operating off of rivers or off of Lake Champlain.
I think the important takeaway, you mentioned at the beginning, Gina, you were looking for some confirmation from us that, you know, you are not alone here, that this is an issue that other systems in Vermont struggle with and have to address in a similar manner. The resolution to what the, you know, two DBPs is going to vary dependent on what the system is. We can certainly confirm that they're, you know, both now and historically, it is an issue that comes up. All surface water systems need to be cognizant of their DBPs depending on their configuration. Some of them are, you know, fortunate that they're not going to exceed the MCLs and they're going to be kind of good with their base configuration, but it is certainly not true across the board. I mean, as Josh just mentioned, you know, the one he was describing first is a very recent system. That's something, you know, within the last couple of months that they've locked in that plan that works for them. The city that we met with this morning, or Josh met with this morning, you know, also actively going through the process, significant change, but it's a different solution that I think makes sense for Barton to be looking at. So it's not so much that we can point to them and say they've done all the legwork that we need to know and we can just kind of piggyback off of that work because the systems are so different in their configuration. But it is certainly accurate to say that there are many systems in the state that deal with this, and Barton is not alone. It's not a unique or the first or the last one that we'll see.
Now, what creates this? I mean, did the storm create
a whole host of you know, possibilities that could have gone into this, whether it was flooding and organic matter loading, whether it was increased temperatures, it could just be aging infrastructure. You know, if you're looking at a filter plant that's, you know, sitting at 25 years old and the media hasn't been refreshed in a long time, that's reducing your ability to handle some of the DBPs that are in the water. So it's really a combination of factors. Your distribution system size, length of pipes, water residence time, all kind of go into what DBPs form, where they form, and you know, what your locational running annual averages end up being.
Because, like, say 5 years ago, we didn't have this issue, and then all of a sudden we're hit hard with it now.
No, and I will say that, you know, the flooding events of 23 and 24 appear to be the catalyst for multiple systems having multiple exceedances, especially during the 24 season. So it's, you're one of several handfuls of systems that have seen issues recently as a result of, you know, varying weather patterns or whatever, but you're, you know, one of the systems that continues to have issues moving forward. But I do think that, you know, from the sounds of it, we have some pretty good options that are available that are non-treatment options.
Right. Well, to go off what you just said about the old media and the filter, we've had this conversation and you're aware. That is in the plan. We actually have a grant to refurbish our filters. The previous operator had planned to do the project himself, and he was going to reuse the media. The feedback I've gotten from multiple people is, don't do that. Replace the media because it's just so old. It's from when we built the plant. So, and the plant's, 40-some-odd years old. So I have gotten quotes for replacement media. I have reached out to the company that we had hired for the refurbishing of the filters, and I was able to extend the grant as long as we get the project done by the end of this year. We're good to go. So that is something that we are going to be doing.
Okay. I was going to expand a little bit on what Josh said a moment ago in response to your question about what the factors are that contribute to this. He described a number of them, and it's, I think it's important to note that there are some which are within your control to a degree, you know, like keeping on top of your chlorine residual levels, your water age, your treatment, your filter efficacy, things like that. You can tweak and adjust and optimize those. You were talking about the impact of the floods recently. One of the interesting, I'll call it a data point, it's not exactly hard and fast, but it's a pretty solid trend we've seen. We're looking at the 23-24 floods with recent current impacts, but looking back to 2011 with Irene, we saw a similar trend where what actually happened in a couple of instances, or appears to have happened in a couple of instances, is the areas that were really hard hit, it came through and it basically scoured, you know, a watershed. And a lot of the organic material that was there got washed down in one fell swoop, and the DBP levels in the years afterwards actually went down, and we've seen them start to creep back up over time as, you know, things are redeposited and, you know, sort of gets back to its natural baseline. So it is very unpredictable and hard to manage how those floods and other natural disasters can impact these things. But when we say, you know, in 23-24, we're seeing this, and it is across the board, and Barton is, again, not an island here. There's many systems. You start to sort of correlate the events with the floods to, okay, we're seeing these DBP issues, and, you know, it appears to be a little bit different impact than Irene, where it actually had a positive impact for a little while. And, you know, maybe the impact just wasn't the same where it completely removed it, but maybe more organic material got washed into your source waters. And, you know, short of dredging an entire pond with, you know, and kind of crossing your fingers and hope that fixes it, you really don't have any control over that, right? That's, right. You know, your pond is what it is.
Right, right. One last thing that I just thought of, and oh my gosh, I hope I didn't just lose it. I just want to get it on record, in your opinion, Barton Village is doing everything appropriately in the state's eyes as far as communicating with you, working with you. You know, I've had some customers call and say, oh, I can't drink the water. And so then I refer back to the notice of violation response, which you provide, and I fill in the blanks that says, we're not telling you not to drink the water, and I'm encouraging those to speak to their healthcare provider to say, what's the risk? And they say, what if I put a filter in? And I say, you can put a filter in, but I can't tell you that that filter is going to remove these. Probably they're not. But again, I can't tell you not to drink the water. I can't tell you to drink the water. But if you don't drink the water, you're going to go to a store and you're going to buy water in a plastic bottle.
So, without getting into direct health impacts, the TTHM's HA5s, their MCL is based on lifetime exposure. So it's obviously going to come up to each individual person whether or not they're comfortable drinking the water. I 100% approve of reaching out to their healthcare professionals because different groups are at different risks.
Yep.
But certainly, you know, this is not an acute contaminant. It's not something that we're going to see and say, oh, you can't drink that water, because it is based on the EPA's estimate of 70-year lifespan of exposure. And so, you know, TTHMs are, you know, associated with some specific cancers. But, you know, I'm not going to say you can drink the water, but I thoroughly agree with your perspective that it's
okay.
Best if you have a concern, you know, if you're pregnant, if you're breastfeeding, if you are, you know, if you're older, please seek out your healthcare provider. That's great advice, and talk to them if you have concerns about it. But it is not an acute contaminant, and you're not going to drink it and fall over
five minutes later.
From
if
it.
You couldn't drink the water, the notice of violation response would be different. It would say,
do not drink.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Do not drink is a very specific order with specific triggers that are not in play here.
Yeah.
You know, echoing what Josh said and what we talked about last week, if folks have health concerns for any constituent in their water, they certainly should speak with their healthcare providers. You know, we as regulators are not healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
We regulate based on the health standards that Josh described. And, you know, when there is a violation which exceeds particular thresholds, which again are not in play here, we would require you to put a do not drink order in place. And that is not what's going on here. So not in any way minimizing, downplaying any of the concerns folks might have. It's just not our role to speak to individual you know, risk and concern at that level. That's really a decision people need to make in consultation with their doctors.
Did want to jump in on the filters, though.
Yeah.
Any carbon filter will do a pretty good job of stripping them out.
One
of the potential treatments for DBPs is to install granular activated carbon. You chlorinate your water beforehand. You let it run through your GAC treatment. It strips it all out, and then you rechlorinate, and you have very little DBPs. That's just kind of
okay.
The pitcher filters are really good at removing many constituents.
Can we get a big filter for our?
The media is just very expensive to replace. Very expensive to replace. It's what's used for PFAS in a lot of cases.
Okay.
Now I have one question. Maybe you guys can answer. Maybe you can't. I have not stopped drinking this water. So, I mean, you're telling me even if I was to drink this amount of what we're getting, if I could live to be 70 years old at drinking this rate of water?
You could. So the way that the risk is calculated by the EPA is they typically look at how much of this do we need to add for a 1 in a million cancer risk chance to increase it by 1 in a million. Those are all under the, EPA IRIS database, which, I mean, you're welcome to look into. It has cancer risks associated with a lot of the various different constituents you can find. But it's really, it's degrees, right? So I want to say it is 7 micrograms per liter for HAA5s that increases your cancer risk by 1 in a million. When you look at concentrations, it gets kind of complicated. But yeah, you could have 1 million people drink this water for 70 years, and you would see the cancer risk increase over that 70 years with individuals that, you know, the aggregate number of people that got cancer will increase. But yeah, you might go from a 1 in a million to a 5 in a million.
And then say, I've been drinking, and I have been, but I've been drinking this water, and we cure the numbers and get it back down, then my drinking what I've drank isn't going to be no more harmful than anything else. It's
that
got
I
a chance
answer.
At causing cancer.
You got to talk to your doctor.
You'd have to talk to somebody well above my pay grade to understand how those cumulative.
They're not going to know how to answer you either.
Well, I think it's important to note, too, that if you were to look at the consumer confidence reports and the data for most any public water system in the world, you're not going to find in the large majority of them 0000 for every single constituent.
Right.
There are limits which are above zero for most things that are in drinking water. And, you know, our public drinking water system, statewide and nationwide, are quite safe. I mean, if you look at the strides that have been made, your risk is never zero with, you know, virtually anything. We're going to walk out of this building and, you know, you're taking a risk in every single thing that you do. But they are objectively quantified limits, which are, you know, under those thresholds that Josh described. So if your TTHMs come down, your disinfection byproducts come down, you could shift and say, well, you know, there's, you know, lead and copper, or, you know, we had a bacteria hit 10 years ago. So if you extrapolate that statistically in the same way, what is my risk of, you know, getting sick or having, a you know, negative health consequences from something like that? So it's never zero. Our job is, you know, again, just to regulate to those limits and, you know, those kind of specific concerns. As Josh said, have to take up with somebody above our pay grade,
right,
in a different profession.
But a good way to look at the DBPs, too, and DBP formation is that it's not just those 4 TTHMs that are in your water or HAA5s that are in your water. There's thousands of disinfection byproducts. Those are the groups that the EPA focuses on as proxies for everything else. So if you can reduce TTHMs, you're reducing the load of DBPs that are in your water system and aren't regulated, because these are the ones that the EPA is focused on as being the most prevalent, and the ones that if you can reduce them, you are likely reducing everything else with them.
Okay.
A bit in the same way that you test for coliform bacteria as an
yeah.
indicator, you're not testing for each individual potential microorganism that could be in your water. You know, coliform is an indicator. As an analogy.
I followed that, but that's because I've been doing a lot of
learning.
No, with
them, I'm sure you have. we've got quite a thing going on here, and I think we just got to take it one step at a time.
Yeah.
get our engineer involved?
I think that you have some great opportunities to try some things that everybody kind of agrees are likely to result in reduced DBPs. Whether or not it reduces them enough, you know, we can't really say, but it, you know, I think you have some opportunities for some lower cost operational changes to your water system that will result in the things you want it to result in.
And some next steps if it's not successful.
And some next steps if it's not successful. And it sounds like you're already planning on, you know, redoing your filters, which, you know, paired that with, you know, tank water level management, it would not surprise me to see a significant reduction between those two things.
So I know you want to get headed back home, but one last question I have. Can you quickly explain the average and the time frame for that average? So, like, how long is it going to be? So let's say we get below that 80 the requirement of below 80 or below, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long, because you do a rolling, is it quarterly average?
It's a rolling annual average that's based on quarterly samples.
Okay.
So samples that so if you take a May sample, right, and I'm trying to remember the months that you sample, like,
We did January.
So you do 1, 4, 7, and 10.
Yeah.
So where you're about to collect your April samples, that's going to include data from January, October, and July. So January of this year, October, and July of last year are both incorporated into that data. And so it takes a year for a really high result to work its way out of your average.
Okay. So we can anticipate, say we find the resolution and they do drop, but we can anticipate notice of alleged violations.
It's very likely that even if you reduced your number, even if you came in with a middle of April, you get a 60, and then July, you get another 60, your numbers are such that you're still going to receive violations during those quarters. However, the state's going to look at your numbers and go, this is the right direction.
Right.
This is what we want to see. And so those, yes, we will issue the violation, but in those cases, in the what is being done portion of public notice, you can tell the story there and say, yes, we're seeing numbers that are significantly reduced. We anticipate by this quarter, these numbers, you won't see these violations or public notices anymore.
So you're looking at least a year once.
I would guess probably 9 months anyways, 6 to 9 months would be the likely outcome of continued notice of alleged violations.
Depends how much lower they get. If you're averaging four quarters and one of them's a zero, you get a significantly lower number than if you're averaging four quarters and one of them's a 79. Both under the MCL, but different lengths of time
to break that average.
Okay. I knew that's what it was, but I knew you would explain it better, so those that are listening and our clerk would get that.
I haven't written anything down.
Bravo. Well done.
It says go to recording.
Oh, there you go. And it's still working, so that's a good thing. Any other questions? Chris, do you have any questions for any of us about water? Okay. Tanner?
Nope, it sounds like we've got a plan.
Okay.
I know Dave's going to be on board for all of it.
Okay.
Talked with him for a couple hours today, went over everything. I know from what they changed over, whatever it was, you guys had come up with last
Matt.
Week.
Matt. Point at Matt.
Last week, and I think they've already seen better numbers just in that time frame.
Yeah. The plant did shut down this weekend, though.
Another power glitch?
No, our turbidity, I think. And maybe made too many changes at one time. I don't know. We had to revert back a little bit for it to get back up and running.
I mean, without necessarily taking up too much time here, you know, as a former operator of a surface water plant with a virtually identical filter set up to yours, it's not uncommon that, you know, essentially what happens if you trip over a preset limit, your plant is going to shut down, and there's a bunch of different things that can be the reason why you went over. Some of them may require a lot of troubleshooting and sort of problem solving to figure it out.
Yep.
You know, adjusting chemical levels, things like that, which can take a longer time to sort of resolve. there are also things which it's like, oh, we just did a cleaning cycle, and for whatever reason, you know, we had dirtier water going through for a longer time than normal. We're just going to lengthen out our cleaning cycles and flush that stuff through before we put it back in service, and we're not going to see that same issue. So
yep.
Give me a call if things go sideways and you guys need some more assistance. I'm happy to work
through that. Yeah, no, Jeremiah and Dave were able to work it through Saturday, and it's been running ever since.
Great.
So that's been good. Yeah. So. Stan, Brad, anything? Next steps, what do you need from us?
So I guess it would be, you know, what we had originally proposed as our engineering services agreement was a pretty broad, larger project to develop a preliminary engineering report to qualify you for funding, and it really focused on development of the well and getting that, the source, permitted and online to evaluate some treatments, thinking that that was going to be kind of the course we've taken. Sounds like we're on a little bit of a different path now, so it sounds like maybe we need to revisit what we would propose, and I guess it would be if you are still trying to lump this into a step one preliminary engineering report type project through the state, then that the duration gets extended because we have to do the EJCDC agreement, it has to get reviewed and approved by drinking water folks, and then your loan application has to go in, get reviewed, approved, and then it all has to be underwritten by VITA. So by the time you get your money, it's a significant time period. So if we want to try and do something a little more abbreviated where we assist on a time and expense basis to look at the more short term, like the tank level, or help you draft up the response to the DBP reduction plan.
Yep. I think that's where we're at because we have to be at this point.
Okay.
Yep.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I mean, at this point... Regardless of whether or not you want to look at that well and develop it further and have that additional source, I think that looking at tank management and
some
quick alternatives
right, to get the number down
makes the most sense. And then having a long-term plan, or if you're just looking at that other source for resiliency, as they mentioned, then that's certainly something that you can decide.
I think it's still, the well is something we should definitely still look at. Yeah. I just think timing. With this issue, we've got to...
There's a tactful way to kind of incorporate that as an option in the plan if this is not reduced.
Okay.
This is another path, and if that's where we head, we'll seek out a step one PER loan to evaluate connection and treatment of that source. So I think we can try and pack this into a smaller bin and do this a little quicker and cheaper and help you with the more short-term focus.
Let's say if you get to a point, I mean, we talked a minute ago about you may, you know, still be over the running annual average, but start to see a really good reduction, you know, with operational changes. Conversely, if they are not successful for whatever reason, you're also going to see that. If that's the case, I would expect that you're going to be wanting to do what Brad and Stan are talking about, where you're looking and coming in for state revolving fund monies to fund a more infrastructure-based project, be that probably aeration, but potentially something else. If that is the case, I know it's shocking to everybody. There's a lot of red tape around these state processes. So do that early. If you get to, you know, two quarters in and you're not seeing an expected reduction that you would have hoped to see by then,
don't wait.
The ball rolling on that because, you know, as Stan just said, those things take time. You're going to be looking, you know, a year out from when you start doing SRF, you know, funding and doing a preliminary engineering report, assessing alternatives, all of that stuff. It takes time. So keep your ear to the ground, pay attention to what those results are and plan accordingly.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yep. Absolutely.
I think we have a good game plan. Thank you. I really appreciate you guys making the trip.
I was going to say, when you're developing the DVP reduction plan, I think the critical conversation is to have with the fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
If for some reason that doesn't go well and he's like, I really don't comfortable taking that, I want that water, and, you know, for whatever reason, and that's a fair assessment, you're probably going to have to pivot over to developing the treat, you know, blending water, or you're going to have to do
aeration.
Or you could do it two different ways. You could say, well, we'll take it offline, lower it, but with the knowledge that if we develop the source and it's successful, we can then put water back in the tank and keep it at 600,000 gallons like you have it now, and you can keep blending. The blending of the water will allow you to put water back in that tank. If that's really something that means a lot to you, it's something you could probably would be successful, if you know what I mean. If you blend enough water, there's a good chance that you will lower the DBPs anyways.
Yeah,
so if there's a big heartburn about lowering the amount of available water storage, You could also just say, well, we're looking at maybe being able to put that back, just we have to keep it down for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
And I don't think that we've ever checked with the fire chief to say any of this stuff.
I've not had a conversation with him.
No. Right.
No.
So he might be like, you know, that's way more than we could ever possibly need. So.
Absolutely. Great.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have any questions,
reach out. Oh, I've got you on speed dial and email speed, Matt, too. Like, whew. Yeah. Thank you. I'm assuming I'll hear from you, one of you.
Yeah, we'll check in. Okay.
Okay.
Appreciate all your time.
Thanks. Yeah, Drive back safe. Thank you. Thanks, Tanner.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving right along. So now I'm going to open back.
Thank you for doing that. That was really informative.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Ted just sent a message. I'm going to log off. Thank you, Ted. Have a good night.
Thank you. You as well.
Thanks.
Bye now.
Bye. I kind of forgot he was on there.
Happy to come back on and say, I'm still here.
He's not still there. No, he said, thank you for having me. That is, Ted that was online is Matt's boss. Yeah. And he wanted to join, so.
Well, he never chimed in, so must be Matt.
Must be Matt did a great job. Yeah, no, they, both of them have been extremely helpful for me. Extremely helpful through all of this. I can't say anything but good. Okay, so I'm going to.